variation. And then from that, we'll see that the way the composite Higgs models have been constructed naturally lends itself to consider an unnatural version. And then from the unnatural version, I'll then discuss how we could test that this model is unnatural, and then I'll conclude. So of course, the story starts with the Higgs discovery. Obviously, it's the crowning achievement of run one. And now that we know that there's a Higgs, we've actually know the two parameters in the Higgs potential. We've got the mass squared parameter, we've got the quartic coupling. Obviously, we knew the ratio for a very long time. The ratio was 246 GeV squared. And now that we've measured the Higgs mass, MH, we can also independently get the quartic coupling. And so that's what the quartic coupling is. It's 0.13, and the mass squared parameter is 89 GeV. Furthermore, we now also have a very good indication that this is a Higgs boson in the standard model, because it's coupling. So this is the coupling here plotted as a function of the particle mass. And what you see is you see a beautiful connection or correlation with particle masses. These are some of the fermions in the standard model. And this is, to contrast it, if you were to plot the gauge couplings, of course, the gauge couplings would just be a horizontal line on this plot, because the gauge couplings obviously don't care about particle mass. So, this is just an upper bound here, I think. Yeah, because it goes all the way down. Yeah. You're right. So the conclusion is that it looks very much like a standard model Higgs boson. By the way, I forgot to make my joke, because my joke over here was that here are some of the events. You can see the Higgs, and if you also go to 750, you can also see a little bump there. That's a joke. Okay, so at this point, you might worry that we're done with the standard model. But as everybody knows, the standard model is not a complete theory of nature. And there are still plenty of questions that need to be addressed. And I've listed most of them here that people have worked on in this room. And there's the Planck weak scale hierarchy. There's the neutrinos and the generations, dark matter, Baryonic synergy, et cetera. And obviously, important questions in gravity and inflation. And so that clearly tells us that we have to go beyond the standard model, and the question is whether the Higgs can tell us anything about it. And so the approach that I want to take in this talk, and is also taken in other beyond the standard model, is to ask the question about the nature of the Higgs boson, and then in answering that question, that will then maybe shed light on some of these other questions. And so clearly, there are two logical possibilities for the nature of the Higgs boson. It can be elementary or composite. If it's elementary, then that leads you towards supersymmetry. Perhaps you don't need supersymmetry. You could just think of the standard model and complete it with other things that are not related to supersymmetry. The other logical possibility is that maybe the Higgs is a composite of new strong dynamics. And that's very natural, very logical possibility. After all, once upon a time, we used to think that the proton was elementary, and it turned out that it isn't. So who's to say that the Higgs boson isn't? So I don't have any preference, obviously, between these two, but I'm going to concentrate on the composite idea in this talk, and understanding why the Higgs is composite will hopefully address some of these other shortcomings in the standard model. But this is just an alternative view of the world. It's not necessarily better than any other view. Yes?
When you say composite, what do you think it's made of something? What's it made of?
It's made of fermions. I'm not going to get to it, but we believe that just like the proton is made of fermions, that there obviously will be new degrees of freedom at a higher scale. And it's easy to make a boson, just two fermions. So that'll be the idea. But that's going to...
What
fermions? Again. Actually, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to talk about it. But the way I'm going to be describing the physics is I'm going to be describing the physics in terms of a chiral Lagrangian. So just like I can describe the physics of the pion with a chiral Lagrangian, we are going to describe the physics of the composite Higgs boson with a chiral Lagrangian description. So I don't care what the UV is, but obviously obviously we'll need a UV description at some point, but it's not going to be crazy. So let me then just run through the idea of the composite Higgs. And the idea is the following, is that we treat the Higgs as a pseudo Nambu-Goldstone boson. So the idea is the following. So we imagine that the strong dynamics, there is a global symmetry group that the strong dynamics has, and that could be related to the fermions. The fermions in this strong dynamics have some global symmetry. And then the strong dynamics spontaneously breaks that global symmetry to some subgroup H at the scale F. So F is going to be my scale for which the strong dynamics will spontaneously break the global symmetry of whatever prions there are there. And then we know what happens is that there are going to be resonances associated with this breaking, and the resonances are going to be proportional to this mass scale F times some coupling. And this coupling is going to be a large coupling. I'm thinking of it like some hadronic coupling in QCD. So it's going to range between 1 and 4 pi. But when you spontaneously break a symmetry, there are going to be Nambu-Goldstone bosons. So there's a massless particle at the bottom there, and that's the Higgs. That will be identified with the Higg. So depending on your coset, you'll have to arrange your global symmetries such that the coset contains a Higgs doublet of the standard model. And this story was first put forth in 84 by George Ian Kaplan, and it's a pretty straightforward story if you understand pions in QCD, because pions in QCD is exactly how this happens. The quarks, left and right-handed quarks, have a global symmetry, SU2 left cross SU2 right. The strong dynamics of QCD spontaneously breaks that down to a diagonal SU2. That diagonal SU2 is the isospin that you see in QCD. And so the pions would be massless in QCD if the symmetry wasn't explicitly broken. And similarly here, the Higgs mass, Higgs potential would be exactly zero. And so the next thing that you have to do to advance this idea is that you have to explicitly break the symmetry. So this global symmetry has to be explicitly broken to generate a non-zero Higgs potential. And in QCD, what happens is that the quark masses explicitly break the global SU2 left cross SU2 right, and the pion gets a mass. So now I want to propose to you a way in which the global symmetry can be explicitly broken. Well, from the after George I. Kaplan's paper, there were a number of proposals in the 80s where people tried to explicitly break the symmetry. They basically relied on giving quarks masses, other quarks masses, et cetera, et cetera. But the way I'm going to break the symmetry is I'm going to break it in a very particular way that was put forth in the mid-2000s. So this idea kind of languished for about 20 years, and then in the mid-2000s, another way was realized to break this global symmetry and generate a Higgs potential. And the way we're going to do it is the following. We're going to imagine that there are two sectors. There's a sector where all the fields are elementary, which means that there's no structure until you hit the Planck scale. And then there's going to be the strongly coupled Higgs sector. So this is the strong dynamics. And these two sectors, they talk to each other via linear mixing terms. So psi represents an elementary field, and it couples to an operator O. The gauge boson is an elementary field, and it couples to some current of this strong dynamics. Now, the current and the operators, they respect the global symmetry of the strong dynamics, but the elementary fields do not. They actually are the elementary fields in the standard model, and they won't necessarily respect the global symmetries of the strong dynamics. So that means that this coupling lambda and g will explicitly break the global symmetry. And that explicit breaking will end up generating a Higgs potential. And what's interesting is that these couplings are actually related. G is actually the gauge coupling in the standard model, and the lambdas, they are actually related to the Yukawa couplings in the standard model. So that means when you generate the Higgs potential, the corrections in the Higgs potential are going to be sensitive to the standard model Yukawa couplings and the gauge couplings. So it's a very particular way to break the global symmetry. I should also mention that this approach, some people might recognize these terms as precisely the terms that you add in the ADS-CFT correspondence, where you create this mixing in the Lagrangian so that you can calculate correlation functions. And that's the that's where this actually came from. But anyway, once you have this mixing Lagrangian, you can close loops of elementary fields and generate your Higgs potential. And so here it is now, where mu h squared and lambda h is what I explained in the beginning. But now notice that the mass squared parameter, it can only depend on the scale f, and it does. And then notice that it depends on some standard model gauge coupling. Some standard model coupling, could be Yukawa or gauge, and it's one loop suppressed. So if you send the standard model coupling to zero, then this mass parameter is zero, you recover the full symmetry. And then also the quartic also depends on the standard model coupling, because that's the source of the explicit breaking. And so you see then that you have this prediction, the Higgs potential is generated at one loop, and now you can then ask yourself, well, let me now arrange it such that I break electroweak symmetry. Obviously, you're trying to get the Higgs VEV. There's only one mass scale in the problem, which is F. So if you want to get 246, F has to be of order 246, has to be of order V. That's because you've only really got one scale in the problem. So that's only the first part. The second part is you also need to get the Higgs mass. So let me just go over here. Notice that the quartic coupling, which controls the Higgs mass, is proportional to a standard model coupling. Well, it turns out that the top Yukawa coupling is the coupling that controls the quartic. So the top Yukawa coupling is going to appear there, and then I'm going to write this coupling as a ratio of masses, which I'll explain here. So we go to the Higgs mass. I've absorbed the Yukawa coupling into the top quark mass, and then the G rho, which here I'm going to call GQ, Q would be a heavy resonance, I'm now writing that as MQ squared over F squared. And so what this formula shows is the following, is that this GQ controls the mass of the Higgs. So by writing it this way, we can relate the fermions. So this would be a fermionic resonance, a top partner resonance. If these top partner resonances are approximately the same as the spin 1 resonances, there's a lower limit of about 2.5 TeV on the spin 1 resonances from the LHC. That then restricts what this GQ can be. GQ can be of order, has to be of order G rho, which it has to be bigger than 3. But if you put 3 into this formula, you'll see that the Higgs mass becomes too heavy. So what happens in composite Higgs models is that the Higgs prediction is a bit heavier than the top quark. So it's actually the opposite of SUSY. In SUSY, it's too small. Composite Higgs, it's too heavy. However, the limit comes from the spin 1 resonances. You don't have to assume that the fermionic resonances are generic with the spin 1 resonances. The reason why that assumption was put in place was because these models came out of extra dimension models, and the Kaluza-Klein of a spin 1 is degenerate with a Kaluza-Klein of a spin 1 half. And so that's why this assumption was made. But you don't have to take that assumption. You can actually imagine that this fermionic resonances are a bit lighter than the spin one resonances, which means that you dial down the GQ. You can take a GQ of order one. That would mean that these resonances would be lighter than the spin one, and then you can explain the Higgs mass. So you can actually bring down the prediction for the Higgs mass to get to 125. And also what's nice about that is that it does predict that there should be light fermion resonances in your theory.
So, I mean, this really just tells you what GQ is.
Exactly. And then, but I'm gonna emphasize that point in a little bit, but notice that GQ is related to the ratio. So what we're gonna see in a couple of transparencies is that when you put limits on MQ, you'll be forced to vary F. And in fact, you'll be forced to make F larger. And if you make F larger, you'll increase the tuning in this model because the ratio has to remain fixed. So that's the story very quickly of composite Higgs models of the last 10 years. Furthermore, you could also ask yourself, well, because you've got all these resonances around, spin one resonances, there's also precision electroweak and also flavor constraints on your theory. And so you can look at the S parameter, which is this dimension six term in the standard model. You can look at the contributions to the S parameter, which go like the W boson mass over the spin one resonances masses, and you can get a limit on the scale F. Similarly, the T parameter also leads to limits, which are quite stringent. Sorry, let me get this out of the way for you. Which are quite stringent. And finally, you can also have flavor-changing neutral currents. These spin one resonances can mediate flavor-changing amongst the light quark fermion, light flavors, and that also leads to a limit of 10 TeV. And so you can see that precision constraints, flavor, prefer that the scale F is very high. And so there's also a little hierarchy in composite Higgs models. So this is a bit like in supersymmetry where you have to worry about the scalar masses. If you don't have some symmetry in the scalar masses which keeps the scalar masses diagonal, if you have off-diagonal terms in the scalar mass matrix in a supersymmetric theory, those scalar masses have to be really heavy. Well, this is similar in the composite Higgs models. Now, of course, we know what to do in supersymmetry. We cook up ways to keep the scalar mass diagonal, such as gauge mediation is a beautiful way. And similarly, you could do the same here. You could alleviate some of the tension here by, I'm going to call it complicating the minimal model, which means that, well, first of all, you can get rid of the T parameter constraint by introducing a custodial symmetry. And then people have also complicated the models by introducing flavor symmetries so that you can avoid this constraint on the F, which is pretty high. However, even if you did that, you should also worry about the fact that we haven't seen any resonances, and these are just two examples of limits. This is Atlas CMS. But the bottom line is that these fermionic resonances, which control the Higgs mass, that control the quartic, they are constrained to be smaller than 600 to 800 GeV, depending on the branching fraction.
This is assuming that little bump really isn't there.
Oh, no. This has got nothing to do with the 750.
Oh, it's got nothing to do with the 750.
Nothing. These are just limits. These are just limits on looking for these fermionic resonances that the LHC looks for. They look for these fermionic resonances in composite Higgs models. This is the equivalent of looking for a stop in a supersymmetric model. So this fermionic resonance has to be light to get the right Higgs mass, and so then LHC looks for these resonances, and these are the limits on these resonances. Actually, I just realized now that I should have updated this because in December 15th last year, this limit was increased to 900, actually. So, I mean, they're really looking for these states because they're easy to produce. They're colored because they're the partner of the top cork, but they're heavy resonances, they're vector-like, and you can easily put limits. So this is analogous to looking for stops and gluinos in SUSY. You look for these fermionic resonances. So, they're just indicative of a composite Higgs model. And as I said, now the limit is 900, and I'll update that. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yep. 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 Yeah, I think they will. Oh. Yeah, but I think that's true. But if I remember now, that I think these branching ratios, you don't necessarily get them in the minimal composite Higgs model. So probably the minimum. Yeah, probably for the minimal model. It would be a bit strange to have a small branching ratio. The branching ratio is much closer to one, is what I remember. Yeah, it depends on the coset. It depends on the coset, yeah. So this is generically the range. Yeah, but you're right, though. I don't remember if I'm not sure if you can cook up a model which has which you can be somewhere in the middle there. Oh, over here?
Yeah.
Oh.
Depending on the shading.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I can see the shading. Maybe you can't see it in the back, but there is some shading here. There's shading there and there. Maybe, yeah. But
anyway, it's
there. Yeah, you're right. Maybe it is in. Maybe CMS is the stronger limit, actually. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's to WB, yeah, because this is like an excited top. But as the limit, so the only takeaway from this slide is that the limit on this top resonance is getting bigger, just like the limits on the stop and the gluino is getting bigger, and because it's getting bigger. This is increasing the tuning in composite Higgs models. And so what I've shown here is that here's an analysis of two composite Higgs models. This is a particular embedding, and this is another embedding of the fermions. And what's done here is just look at the tuning of a composite Higgs model. So this is the tuning as a function of this fermionic resonance. But remember that the fermionic resonance goes like GT times F. But GT, as was pointed out in the question, GT controls the Higgs mass. So you don't have freedom to move GT. So the only way, as the lower bound on MT increases, you have to increase F. But if you increase F, you increase the tuning. And that's why you see that as MT increases, the tuning gets more and more, which is what you expect.
So is this related to the Higgs mass quadratic divergence? Is that supposed to be a Higgs mass higher?
Right. So what's happening here is that the way the Higgs gets its mass, what's happening here is that the Higgs is just, you need a very large coupling in the quartic. And so what's happening is that the Higgs is becoming too heavy. In other words, this model is because it's tying the explicit breaking of the symmetry to the top quark, and because the top quark Yukawa coupling is too big, the mass of the Higgs boson is bigger than what the experiment says. So you're forced to dial down this parameter if you dial down GT, that then dials down, it brings the resonances down as well. So it's because they're interrelated. It's not as if it's a free parameter.
It's the old top condensate.
The old top condensate models, they predicted a very heavy top, if I remember. So it is similar in that sense, but the mechanism is totally different there, because what you were doing in the top condensate is you were identifying the Higgs as a TT bar bound state. And so the actual mass of the Higgs boson was related to the mass of the constituent fermions. So it would be like looking at a BB bar resonance, an upsilon, bottomonium, something like that. Whereas this is not the approach I'm taking. The approach I'm taking is that the Higgs is more like a pion and the quark masses are irrelevant. The masses of the constituent fermions are irrelevant. Its mass is coming from another external source of explicitly broken symmetry.
I'm having trouble reading the color, the legend for the colors. What are the different colors?
Oh, yeah, no, that's just, these authors, they did a scan over various permutations of the composite Higgs model. So the yellow is, actually, I can't read it myself. No, the yellow is just, the particular, This top partner, it can have different quantum numbers depending on how you embed the fermions into the composite Higgs model. So this is just a detail of various quantum numbers. And so they're just scanning over the different ways you can embed the fermions into the global symmetry multiplets. And there is some freedom there in how you do that. But generically, I think, again, you just see that the tuning increases. And over here, it's the black line, which is the smallest you can get. So I forgot they scanned over all various masses and couplings. But what they did in these two plots is they actually imposed the Higgs mass constraint, which up until this was from last year, July last year, up until that point, people hadn't put in the Higgs mass constraint. And so when you went to a composite Higgs talk, a lot of people would say, oh, composite Higgses are still not so tuned. But in reality is if you include the Higgs mass constraint, well, they are a little bit more tuned. I mean, of course, I don't want to get into what's tuned, what's not tuned. I mean, you can tell if something's tuned if you just have a gut feeling, right? So that's the that was the introduction. But I hope I didn't bore people with that because the rest is going to be detail. Well, once you get the basic idea, the rest is just details, which I don't think it's. I think it. Yeah, you don't miss the point if you don't understand the introduction and motivation. So therefore. Based on this fact that the composite Higgs models, they look like they're already starting to be tuned, and they also need to be complicated, I'm going to take the approach, a very simple approach, is just to do what the experiment is telling you to do. The experiment is telling you to take, remember what F was? F was the scale where this global symmetry is broken. Well, just take it to be what the experiment tells it to be. It tells it that F has to be 10 TeV. And of course, when you do that, you just throw away all this complication of symmetries, which is okay. I'm not saying it isn't, but you don't need it. And so, of course, this approach is unashamedly like split Susy. In split Susy, it's the scalar masses which control the flavor-changing neutral currents, and by putting the scalar masses really heavy, you also eliminate that problem very simply. So that's the similar approach that I'm taking here. But now, of course, there's no free lunch. By increasing the scale F, we know, again, that the mass squared parameter is controlled by F. So that means that you've got a minimum amount of tuning in these models, which is the best you can do is one part in 10,000. So at this point, you might say, oh, that's really bad. How could you do that? You know, and then, well, you'd have to complain about split Suzy as well. But I would offer the answer that you're doing better than 10 to the minus 28 in the standard model. So you have made progress. Yeah. Sorry. Oh yeah, this is taking. This is assuming that you have the standard model all the way. You have the standard model, and then nothing else until the gut scale, and so any gut. Yeah, any gut masses to the Higgs would give you this, contributions would give you that tuning to get 100 GeV. So the strong dynamics, when it generates this Higgs potential, there's some tuning in that Higgs potential. Now, I don't know where it comes from. I'm just going to assume it. I can't give you the UV description of what gives you this tuning. However, I can, the only way I can argue is look at our only theory of strong dynamics, which is QCD. And QCD has a very interesting sensitivity. The sensitivity is the following, is that electromagnetic corrections in QCD, if all the quarks were massless, would make the proton heavier than the neutron. So in QCD, the proton would decay to the neutron. But what happens in QCD is that the quark masses have the values such that the neutron becomes heavier than the proton. So the down quark is heavier than the up quark. So that switches the neutron and the proton and prevents the proton from decaying. So there's a sensitivity in the up and down quark masses to the neutron to one part in 1,000.
You can still change the up and down by order 1, right? Before the proton starts decaying inside the nucleus.
Yeah, as long as you keep that ratio fixed, that's right. Up and down ratio.
Yeah, yeah.
But what's interesting is that we know what, if you had just thought about QCD and someone told you how you were going to make the proton heavier than the neutron heavier than the proton, and you were to do it this way, I mean, people would it'd be crazy, right? You're going to introduce a whole new sector. I'll call it the electroweak sector with the Higgs and couplings with the Yukawa couplings, and I'm going to arrange the down-type Yukawa coupling to be different from the up-type Yukawa coupling just so the proton doesn't decay. Yeah, I would believe that. Because that would give you a stable universe. So you would have to, but that's what's happening in QCD. Okay, so that's just for argument's sake. Coming back here, I don't know what's causing the tuning in the Higgs potential from the new strong dynamics, but let's go with it, let's run with it and see how far we go. So then the next question is, well, okay, great, you're going to take F to be bigger than 10 TeV, why don't I just take F to be 10 to the 16 GeV? And then I've got a really great prediction, I just get the Higgs mass and nothing else and I'm done. So who's to say that when you satisfy all the flavor constraints, that F isn't just incredibly large and all this is irrelevant. So what I want to claim is that there is a motivated upper bound for F. So in fact, you can't take F arbitrarily large, and therefore there is a window for which you actually will get some interesting prediction at low energy. So that's what I want to explain next. And the idea comes back to the partial compositeness, because again, with the theme that the new physics that you add should try and solve as many questions of the standard model as you can. And another nice feature of composite Higgs models is that they also explain the fermion mass hierarchy. And they explain it in the following way. Let's go back to this partial compositeness where the elementary fermions mix with composite operators. And here I'm only showing the terms for left and right-handed fermions. This type of coupling can actually explain the fermion mass hierarchy in the following way. It was actually first noticed by Kaplan again. This is the big Kaplan, like the Georgi Kaplan. In 91, he put forth an explanation with these terms, but you can also get this from an extra dimension as well. But the way you explain the fermion mass hierarchy is the following, is that the fermions will mix. See, this will cause a mixing with a composite sector. And then when you mix with a composite sector, you then talk to the Higgs, and that's how an elementary fermion would get its mass. So the question is, what's the size of these mixings? Because then the fermion mass would be proportional to these mixings times the Higgs VEV. Well, those mixings depend on the dimension of this operator O. You see, because you have strong dynamics, the anomalous dimensions of those operators can be of order 1. And if you play around with the anomalous dimensions of these operators, you can make the lambda L and the lambda R, you can make them irrelevant couplings. And so if you make them irrelevant couplings, they can become really tiny in the IR. And that's what I've indicated here. They will scale like some scale in the IR divided by a UV scale, but they are proportional to the dimension of that operator. So this is an elementary fermion, so it has canonical dimension 3/2. If lambda were dimensionless, then this should have dimension 5/2. But a composite operator can deviate from that 5/2 dimension by order 1. And so you can easily create hierarchies in these mixing parameters. So if you state that light fermions are mostly elementary, that corresponds to having a composite theory where the dimensions of these operators are bigger than 5/2. And then if the dimension of that operator is bigger than 5/2, all you need is a power bigger than 1 here, and you'll get a big hierarchy. On the other hand, you don't want that to happen for the third generation. So this picture tells you that the top quark must be mostly composite, because that would then mean that the dimension of this operator is of order 5/2. You now have a marginal coupling, and marginal couplings, they run logarithmically. So if it starts out order 1 in the UV, it'll still be order 1 in the IR, and you can still explain the top mass. But this coupling points to the fact that the top quark is mostly composite. And remember that this was the type of coupling that generated the Higgs potential, because it was the top Yukawa coupling that generated the Higgs quartic. So this particular composite Higgs framework also explains the fermion mass hierarchy. So the two are related.
So just the B quark won't do this.
Right? Exactly. So the B quark will be something in between. Obviously, the closer you get to 5/2, you can reduce that.
But I mean, the B quark's a whole lot lighter than the top.
That's right. So in this picture, the B quark, the way we say it is we say that the B quark is mostly elementary, and it has a little admixture of compositeness due to this mixing. So there are varying degrees of compositeness in the standard model fermions. The top quark is completely composite, and the rest have varying degrees. And obviously, the lighter the fermion, the more elementary it is. So it's a totally different view of how we picture the standard model. We have this, we split. Yeah, yeah.
I would assume totally composite. Yes. The dimension is 5/2.
Good, yeah.
So
it's because.
Plus epsilon or something?
Yeah, it is. Because what I have to do here is I'm distinguishing here between left handed top and right handed top. It turns out that because the left handed top is in a doublet with B left, and because we've measured the Z B left coupling, you can't put too much compositeness into T left. So it has to all be in T right. So that's a constraint from experiment. But it'll turn out that having a composite T right is what you want, actually.
What's preventing you saying at this point
also composite? Nothing, but it would just disagree with the data here.
What?
It would disagree in this picture, because in that case so let me go back. where was it? Oh, here. It turns out for the gauge boson, right? So here's the coupling for the gauge boson. It couples to an operator in the CFT. Sorry, did I say CFT? I shouldn't have said that. It couples to an operator in the strongly coupled theory. And here I've indicated that that operator is a vector current. But gauge invariance preserves the dimension of that vector current. It actually has to be dimension 3, so this coupling is always marginal. So in this theory, the gauge boson can't be composite because of gauge invariance. What's that, sorry?
It's strange that nature would do this. It's saying the Higgs boson is composite.
Yeah. But what is that? What was that last thing you said? Yeah, but again, this just agrees with the data. We see that the gauge couplings, there's no deviations in the gauge couplings. We've measured them fairly well. If there was some compositeness in the W and the Z, we would start to see corrections to those gauge couplings. We don't see it. So the only coupling that hasn't been measured is the top, hasn't been measured very accurately, would be the top. So we could still allow 10%, 20% deviations in the top coupling, which would be the sign that the composite, that the top quark is composite. So it's not for me to question nature. I mean, I just look at the data and I say, this is what the data is. This is consistent with the data. I mean,
But turning it around, this is falsifiable.
This is falsifiable. Oh.
So you're asking how much composite this could be.
Exactly.
Is, and then people will clobber it with data, and either it will.
Exactly.
If you're right, then all this will be falsified.
But to get inside nature's mind and say what was nature thinking? I don't know what nature. Well, I'd love to know what nature was thinking, but we can only work from the data. This is consistent with the data. But it's not as if I'm just adding something with a parameter and I'm dialing the parameter and I'm writing a paper. What I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to put the whole thing together into a complete structure. Because after all, this is what you do in supersymmetry. Supersymmetry is a great extension of the standard model because precisely it constrains itself and tries to solve the outstanding problems. It's not just a hit and run type of a model. And I'm trying to do the same here. I'm connecting these parameters so that I'm constraining myself.
So what is saying the upper bound on F is, I'd like to hear about that.
Oh.
The upper bound.
So maybe we could save the question till the end so we can hear the end of the model.
Yeah, is that okay? did you want to finish this point or you're okay? No, okay. No, it's okay. I think it's science.
I'm sorry for
you. No. It's perfectly fine. This is how science proceeds. So this is consistent with what we see, with what we measure with the coupling. So what I can tolerate is a composite right-handed top, because we haven't measured the right-handed couplings as well as the left-handed ones. So the final, I'm trying to get to this upper bound. So what I claim now is that when you have a composite right-handed top, it actually helps to unify the standard model gauge couplings. And this was again noticed in the mid-2000s. So what happens is the following. Because the right-handed top is composite, it now has to be in a complete multiplet of the unbroken global symmetry, which means that the top sits in a complete H multiplet. H is the unbroken global symmetry. Well, that means then that at low energies, you'll also have multiplet partners of the right-handed top. Now, those multiplet partners we obviously haven't seen. So you have to decouple the multiplet partners. And the way you do that is you add top companions, which are elementary fields, in such a way that the top companions, they have charge conjugate numbers, so that you form a Dirac mass with the composite states, and that Dirac mass decouples those companions to put them at the scale lambda F, where lambda is just a coupling is just a coupling of the Dirac mass. So you say, okay, you're forced into doing this now. What does this mean? Well, it turns out that these top companions actually give a contribution to the standard model running of the gauge couplings, and they do it in a very interesting way. If you look at, this is the alpha in the standard model. Let me just take differences of the couplings. Because this model is just the standard model, there's going to be a contribution to the one loop beta function coefficients just coming from the standard model. But when you go above the scale F, you have to subtract out the contribution of the composite Higgs and the composite top. So that's the first two contributions. Then to take into account the top companion contribution, you have to subtract out another contribution, another right-handed top contribution. And this takes into account the top companions. When you do that and look at the one-loop beta function coefficients, you find that the ratio, so B2 minus B, the B's are the coefficients of the one-loop running, you get 0.69. And this was noticed, as I said, in the mid-2000s. If you do the same exercise in the MSSM, you get 0.71. And I think you can predict this ratio just from the measured values, and I think the measured values give you 0.72. So SUSY does well, as we all know, but so does this. This also does just as good. But notice what happens in MSSM. In the MSSM, you add the Higgsino, you add the Gauginos, and that's what fixes the running. What's happening here is that you're subtracting out the contributions from the composite Higgs, composite top, and also adding in these top companions contribution, and that also helps. So when you do that, so if you want to preserve this story, that will then give you an upper bound on F. Sorry? I'll tell you those groups in a little while, yeah. Exactly. So now here's the problem. Unlike MSSM, where it's a perturbative theory and you can calculate at one loop, then you can go to two loop and you can get very precise, obviously here, because once you go above the scale F, you're into this composite theory, the calculability is lost. But let me first, you can see that if you plot the three couplings, this is just a pictorial representation of that ratio. And you can see that you get reasonable unification. So that would be the story coming from the one loop. You can now estimate higher order effects, and that's what we tried to do here. We tried to estimate the prediction for alpha 3 at the Z scale, which is here. So delta 3 being 0 means you get the right prediction. And then we put a band in this prediction. So we introduced the two loop effects, and we gave some reasonable values for those coefficients that was what you would expect from some UV gauge theory. And then we created these bands. And you can see, obviously, that the bands deviate from zero the higher you make the top companion mass. Because remember that the top companions were supplying a crucial contribution to the running of the gauge couplings. As you decouple the top companions, make them heavier and heavier, this prediction will deviate, will get worse and worse. So if you want to preserve this one loop result, it's a curiosity. Maybe it's a total coincidence. I don't know. But if you want to preserve it, then that gives you a loose upper bound on these top companion mass, which means there's an upper bound on F. So requiring that at least these bands include zero, you get a very loose upper bound of 500 TeV. So again, this is similar to what you do in Split SUSY. In Split SUSY, you try and push the Gauginos and the Higgsinos heavier and heavier until you lose the prediction, and then that puts an upper bound on the SUSY scale. And this is the same story, except that the uncertainties are much larger.
Well, in SUSY, you can have
That's right. Yep.
By the way, what is your, how does the unification scale vary with the change in F? How much does it vary? Because it shows us that this started from the TEV, this 15.
Yeah.
10 to the 15 is starting from the TEV.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't remember. I think it doesn't vary that much, but obviously this is the scale where you include the contributions of the top companions, but as you make them heavier, this will become, the unification will become worse. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there is some dependence, but it's not that much. So therefore, I've now sandwiched my problem. My lower bound comes from flavor constraints, which is 10 TeV, and I've got this loose upper bound of 500 to 1,000. Clearly, making this an intermediate scale, like 10 to the 11 GeV, is clearly going to lose this one-loop prediction. So again, all the faith here is in this one-loop result, which is curious that you get in composite Higgs models. And that's really what I'm basing this upper bound on. And so now, in the remaining 5 minutes, oh, okay, so 10 minutes. I will now just give you some more details of how you construct a composite Higgs model which preserves these features. And so first of all, you want the minimal coset. So the minimal coset that contains, well, what does the minimal coset have to contain? Well, it has to contain the global symmetry of your UV theory has to contain SU5, because you don't want any contributions coming from the constituents of the strongly coupled theory. So those constituents better preserve SU5 so that you get universal corrections to the running. And furthermore, in the spirit of split SUSY and supersymmetric models, we would also like to restrict this coset so that we can also get dark matter out of it. And that's following ideas where people use these introduce singlet scalars just to solve the dark matter problem. And here we're trying to put it all together. And it turns out that this is the minimal coset that we found which could do that. Now, this coset has 12 Nambu-Goldstone bosons. And what's nice about this 12 is that they arrange themselves into a 5 of SU5. These are complex scalars, so there's 10 degrees of freedom here, and then there's a complex scalar singlet, which will play the role of the dark matter. And then obviously, as you know, the 5 of SU5 splits into a doublet, which I'll call D, which will be the Higgs doublet, and then obviously the 5 has the triplet partner. And this triplet will be our handle into verifying this model. I should probably skip all this. Now you have to embed the matter. You have to embed the matter under this global symmetry, and then you have to. There was a question about where does the composite top sit? It sits into a 15 of SU6, and then the 15 of SU6, the top companions would be everything besides the right-handed top. So you can see that, so I've put a tilde on the top companions. I've called that chi before, and that these would be the top companions. These are the states that pair up with the composite states and decouple the multiplet partners of T right in the 15. T right is three-dimensional, so there are 12 other fermions that you have to decouple from the 15. And these are the 12 fermions with their standard model quantum numbers.
Can I ask
yeah.
that from the
self explanatory
there? So, what about proton decay?
Yeah, I mean.
So, that's why you have a separate.
Yeah. Exactly.
UV,
yeah.
Because your unification scale is a bit low.
Yeah, exactly. The unification scale is around 10 to the 15. You can't compute it accurately because of the two loop effects.
Yeah.
But then, in order. Yeah, I'll just jump to the story. I mean, you don't want the triplet to mediate proton decay, so you have to impose baryon and lepton number. And as you know, that doesn't commute with the standard model fermions. So you're forced to introduce each standard model fermion into its own 10 and its own 5 so that you can assign baryon number to each of those fermions.
It's like orbifolding.
Thank you, yeah. So this is like orbifold guts, that's right.
Yeah.
So we're just doing the non-extra dimension picture of it. Normally this is achieved with the orbifolding is achieved. Actually, even the way you decouple the top companions, that's also with an orbifold.
I see.
Because, you know, you can put the... Yeah, yeah. But the kind of the slick way to say it is that the top companions give the partners a Dirac mass and you decouple them. Okay, I'm not going to go into the details because I've run out of time. But then you have to integrate out the strong sector, and the idea now would be to generate the Higgs potential. Let me just say that the top companions. Notice that the top companions here. I've put tildes on them. The top companions, because they're elementary, they will also mix into the composite sector. So the top companions also have this mixing parameter lambda, which controls their mass. And the standard model quarks, they obviously, their parameters are related to the Yukawa coupling, but this is a free parameter for the top companions. So the top, but this is perturbative, so you can't make this parameter much larger than 1. And then you go through the motions, you compute the potential from closing off the loops. So sorry that I, is that okay? I'm just skipping through this because I don't want to go way over time. And then at the end of the day, you obtain the Higgs potential. And remember, D here stands for the Higgs doublet. And this is a different parameterization. I've written it that way now. But this is obviously the Yukawa coupling, the mass squared parameter. But you can see that to get the right electroweak VEV, we knew that V has to be, generically V is of order F. And if F is really big, the only way you can get this equation to be satisfied is if this alpha is tuned. And that's what I'm doing. I'm tuning this alpha contribution in order to get the right electroweak VEV. The Higgs mass, it turns out for this coset, the Higgs mass is controlled by gauge coupling. And so you're basically sensitive to the W boson mass there. But here's alpha, and you can see that now alpha is contributions from Yukawa couplings and from gauge couplings. And this is where the cancellation has to happen such that alpha is a tiny number, say one part in 10,000. So obviously, I can't give you the reason why that cancellation happens. They're just free parameters. Then you also have to check the scalar potential and the triplet potential. And you have to make sure that you don't break the symmetry, the color for the triplet. Triplet is charged under QCD. What's nice about the triplet is it has similar contributions to the doublet, but because the triplet is colored, it gets a big contribution from QCD and keeps the triplet mass positive, which is nice, so you don't break color. And then the singlet also doesn't get any gauge contributions, it just gets Yukawa contributions. And then there are various possibilities for the triplet and singlet mass. So again, apologize for rushing through this. The other thing that you have to arrange is that you want to make sure that the dark matter is stable. And you can do that because the coset is really big. There are lots of U1s, and there's a nice linear combination of the U1s, which then enables you to stabilize the dark matter. No, I'll tell you. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll tell you in a minute, yeah. So you can actually define a baryon triality. Well, you can define a baryon number, and you see that the singlet has non-zero baryon number, and then the baryon triality leads you to stability, provided that the singlet is a lighter state and doesn't decay into the triplet. So that's just model building details. And then, so here's the cartoon. So this is the spectrum. So this is what we call the unnatural or split model, is that you basically, your scale F is really heavy, so the resonances are really heavy, you're never going to see them. And then the Nambu-Goldstone bosons, the pseudo-Nambu-Goldstone bosons, they remain light, but they get their masses from the Yukawa couplings and gauge couplings. You've tuned the Higgs to be the lightest. The singlet is generically lighter than the triplet, and the triplet is heavier because it's got the QCD contribution. The top is also composite, and then you've split the multiplet partners of the right-handed top. You've split them with the top companions, and the top companions sit up at around 10 TeV. They're there to split the multiplet, and they're also there to guarantee unification. So the low energy spectrum is very simple. It's an opposite spin version of split Suzy. Here it's the bosons which are light, whereas in split Suzy it's the fermions are light because of R symmetry. Here the bosons are light because of the global symmetry, global shift symmetry. Yeah.
But S now, okay, I'm thinking about
that. That's next. Yep. So in this model, you can also compute up to order one numbers. You can compute the singlet will behave like dark matter, and it'll couple to the doublet. There is this term in the potential. And this kappa, you can relate it to F. Well, this is dimensionless coupling, but you can relate it to a ratio of M chi. And so you can look. So here I've plotted the top companion mass, which controls the F. And then I plot it as a function of the scalar singlet mass and put limits from xenon 100 and over closure. And you can see that what's interesting is that provided that the singlet mass is between 180 and 10 TeV, you want to be near this line here, you can explain the relic density. As you go up here, this eventually becomes strongly coupled.
But it's not strongly coupled with the standard
model. No.
The standard
model
is very
So
it annihilates to
what?
It annihilates
to Higgs bosons. What's the annihilation? It's to Higgs bosons, via this coupling. People have looked at this model. This is known as the Higgs portal model, and people put limits on the kappa. Because we've got a complete model, we related this kappa to our parameters. So that's all we did here. We took, I guess I didn't give the references where people do this Higgs portal. You take those papers and you just take their limits on kappa and put it as a limit on M chi, and that's all we did here. But that's right, it's a Higgs portal. And then obviously, this is almost a joke, this transparency. Obviously, because F is really large, you're not going to get any deviations to the Higgs couplings. You can look for the exotic states, but the exotic states are the top companions, which are exotic states, you can look for them. They sit at 10 to 20 TeV, so you're not going to produce them. And that's the last thing in the last minute. The only thing that you can look for here, which is relatively light and colored, is the triplet scalar. So remember the triplet, this is the Higgs partner. This is the color Higgs partner. And it has quantum numbers like a right-handed bottom in Suzy. Now, if you put F of 10 TeV, generically, this triplet mass is in the 3 to 5 TeV range. And what it turns out that this triplet can only decay via higher dimension terms, and that's got to do with the fact that we have a lot of symmetry, and that symmetry was needed for proton decay and dark matter stability, which at the end of the day, cut a long story short, means that this triplet can only decay via this dimension 6 term, which is suppressed by 1 over F squared, where F is 10 TeV. And so here's the decay mode. It decays into top, bottom, and the singlet, which is the dark matter. So this is jets plus missing energy would be the signal. And you can see that here's the decay length. It's typically of the order of the millimeter. It's typically millimeter size, but it depends on F. And the bigger you make F, the longer lived it is. So this is, again, just completely analogous to the gluino in Split Susi, where the gluino, because the scalar masses are really heavy, is long-lived. And so this is the spin zero version of the gluino story. And then here's the cartoon so here's the triplet mass, this triplet scalar. Here's the scale F. And again, we're thinking of F to be bigger than 10 TeV, and you basically are in this region of displaced decays and collider stable decays. There is a region of prompt decays for very heavy triplets, and that could also be searched for eventually. But that, again, this plot is also, I could have replaced here the scalar mass, and I could have put the gluino mass. In fact, I think we took that plot from their paper and just changed the labels. No, I didn't. This is not... Oh, no, we didn't do that, sorry. No, we recalculated it, sorry. And then finally, the more our recent work, we just did a little bit more of a detailed study of the displaced vertices and the long-lived decays. And so, for example, at the moment, these long-lived scalars, these R hadrons, which form out of these scalars, limits about 800 GeV, and then these are projections for this triplet at the end of run two. So here we looked at the R hadron means that you produce a charge hadron, escapes the detector. And this is displaced vertex with jets, and then displaced vertex with missing energy, because that's what our triplet can decay into. And you can see that you can go up to about, at run two, you can go up to about 1.8 TeV, probably similar to long-lived gluinos. And then here's the plot for future 100 TeV collider. There is a window where you can look for prompt decays if the triplet is significantly heavy. That's for an F of 10 TeV. If F is 100 TeV, it's mostly long-lived and displaced decays, and you can go all the way up to 10 TeV. All right, so that's my summary. My summary is the following. If you just say that F is bigger than 10 TeV, you basically take care of all precision constraints. This assumes that the Higgs potential is tuned and leads to the split model. The minimal coset is this particular structure here, and this was chosen in order to explain the following two facts. It improves this gauge coupling unification, this curious one-loop result, and it also, as we know, it can take care of the fermion mass hierarchy. Then there's a color triplet, and the singlet are the Higgs partners, and then the long-lived decay is the sign of unnaturalness. Thanks very much. We're thinking of the scalar dark matter as just pure dark matter, so you'd have to look for it in direct detection experiments, such as the xenon.
You can't detect this from LHC?
At the LHC, the problem would be the production of it, yeah.
It'd be similar to
these Higgs portal dark matter models. So with the Higgs portal, you have to produce it via a Higgs.
But in principle, you could use...
Oh, yeah, in principle, yes. But we didn't...
You have no idea.
Oh, we didn't study it in detail, yeah. We didn't study in detail yet, yep.
Sorry, what was the 3D
Top, top quark, bottom quark, and then the dark matter. Yeah, I mean, the triplet does decay via jets and missing energy. So if you saw that signal, then you would have indirect evidence for this singlet dark matter at the LHC. That's right.
Dark matter is very heavy. It's a CEV. So there are constraints for galaxy halos. Also, reduction of mistakes. So this is why we're looking for Higgs winch. Why the 2 10 to G. You have a very, very heavy. Well, 180 GeV.
Yeah.
Well, even so, it's not
GeV. No, well, it could still be 500. It could still be, I mean, there's still plenty of room here. Are you worried about annihilation in the center of a galaxy?
No, he's worried about, are you worried about self-interactions?
No, I'm talking about...
This is very heavy. This is a tiny particle. It has nothing to do with what effect. If the cross section is small, it will affect nothing in the structure of galaxies. It will behave like all dark matter.
Yeah, it's like a wimp. Yeah, that you can check, yeah. Yeah.
I have one last question. Yeah. Supersymmetry MSSM is 122 free parameters. The standard one has 21, 22. How many do you have?
I mean, of course, here, the parameters that I have that are undetermined are related to the strong dynamics. And maybe it's of order the standard model. I didn't count them specifically. But again, I don't see that as the point, because I'm constraining, what I'm doing is I'm constraining those parameters to have order one values. And within that, I get a predictive framework. So it's not as if I can get whatever I want in this. So that's not the question that affects me here. But obviously, yeah, I do have parameters, which I probably think is of order the standard model.
Unnaturalness is considered a bad word in the community.
I know. Well, but again, remember that here, I mean, unnaturalness, I agree, it's a loaded word. But here, I tried to argue that it's of the order of the unnaturalness in the QCD.
All right, on that note, let's give Tony.